When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On August 31st, 1972, Helen Hanks, a pretty 34-year-old mother of three, disappeared from her place of employment at Wilcox Advertising in Valdosta, Georgia. After a brief investigation by local and state authorities, the case went cold. In the fall of 1980, a farmer clearing a field south of town discovered a buried object, a box containing the dismembered remains of the missing woman. After several months of investigation, police arrested Foxy Wilcox, his son Keller Wilcox, and two long-term African-American employees of Wilcox Advertising. Keller was charged with Hanks' murder and the others with concealing a death. The Wilcoxes were members of a prominent and wealthy Valdosta family. To defend their case, they hired famed defense attorney Bobby Lee Cook. Keller Wilcox's murder trial in January 1982 pitted Cook against a local prosecution team led by District Attorney Lamar Cole. The case against Wilcox was entirely circumstantial, making the outcome uncertain. After a trial marked by controversy and conflicting testimony, Wilcox was convicted and sentenced to life in prison, all the while proclaiming his innocence. In 1985, he was freed by a federal judge based primarily on the harsh interrogation of the black witnesses. The true story of this horrific murder has all the elements of a work of suspense fiction: money, power, sex, race, and the haves versus the have-nots. Multiple lives were forever changed. The outcome would have been totally different if the box had been buried only 6 inches deeper. The book that we're featuring this evening is 6 Inches Deeper, The Disappearance of Helen Hanks, with my special guest, author William Rawlings. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, William Rawlings.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this book. I just discovered it, as I mentioned, speaking to you beforehand. This book was released in 2020, but I've just discovered your work, and congratulations on this incredible book. Let's get right to Valdosta, Georgia. Maybe you can just tell us where this is. You say it's about 15 miles to the south of the Florida state line, but tell us a little bit about Valdosta and the one person and a person named Ernest Keller Wilcox Sr. and how he came to be in the area and his background.
Valdosta, Georgia is a town of perhaps 40,000 or so people in the extreme south of the state of Georgia. It's a part of the state that historically was nothing but great pine forest and later on became famous for turpentine production. And in fact, most of this area has probably withered on the vine because there's not a lot of industry, there's not a lot of agriculture there now. But Valdosta is different in the fact that the interstate I-95 was put through in the 1960s, and it sort of became a regional center,
right.
Sort of an island of urbanity in the middle of rurality, if I can use that term. And a lot of it's sort of the dominant town in the area. The Wilcoxes were there since the early part of the 20th century. The grandfather of Keller Wilcox, who was the prime person in this saga, was an attorney, as was his father, Foxy. They did well business-wise and married well over the years. And so by the time this tale took place, they were a very well-respected family because of their tenure. Things in the South have less to do with money than they do with family and social connections. But also, they made a good bit of money and were fairly wealthy. They were, as I say in the book, I think the creme de la creme of the South society.
You talk about Foxy Wilcox having a background with his grandfather being an attorney and his father, but you say that he soon lost interest in the law. Tell us about what his new interest was.
To get this straight, the person eventually indicted most prominently for this murder was Keller Wilcox, who was born in 1950. His father, Foxy Wilcox, was an attorney who, like many attorneys over the years, may turn to something else. And he became very successful in the outdoor advertising business. And that's where much of the income came from. Keller, on the other hand, was, at the time of this story began, was just in the midst of college. He had just gotten married, was a younger man. He was the only child of his two parents. And certainly he had before him a bright future if he simply maintained that which he would inherit. So that sort of sets the background for what happened in August 1972.
You say there were prominent people in this community, but tell us a little bit more about this advertising company and its employees and what they actually did and some of the challenges or the real challenge that faced them in 1980.
To back up, outdoor advertising means basically billboards. And as you are probably aware, billboards are everywhere. Prior to the administration of Lyndon Johnson in the late 1960s, they were unregulated more or less on federal highways. And the company, in fact, the entire industry, a billboard industry, faced a lot of challenges about getting their billboards up. But they did well. They did well. And both Foxy, the father, and Keller, the son, they both actually had the same name, which is Ernest Keller Wilcox. They did quite well in the business and had markets all across South Georgia and North Florida. Things were really doing well. Employees consisted of the father and son in the office, and they would have a secretary, perhaps, plus a few salesmen. But the main fleet of their employees were persons who put up and took down the billboards. So these were all African American, and that fact came into play later in the story.
Now, you talk about this business that they had, and they had a secretary that joined in 1972, the same year that Keller joined his father in this company as a salesman and marketing. So tell us a little bit about Helen Griffin.
Helen Griffin Hanks, she was married to a man named James Hanks, was 34 years old in 1972. She was the mother of three children. She had worked, apparently very intelligent lady from all that I have been able to find out. She had previously worked for another timber company there in Valdosta, but had come to work early in 1972 for a 20% raise, giving her a weekly salary of $120 per week. Her husband, James Hanks, was a prison guard, making a modest salary. And between the two of them, they were raising three children and probably struggling a bit. But she was said to be very intelligent, very hardworking, and a very honest, salt of the earth kind of person who was in a position of secretary for this company.
Tell us about the situation with Keller in terms of his marital status.
Keller had been going to college at Valdosta College at the time. It's now Valdosta State University, but he started off college and early on had wanted to go to medical school, supposedly, but that didn't pan out. And actually, after about his in his third year of college, he actually dropped out and went to work for his father full time. He had been going out with a girl named Jean King, that's J-E-A and King, and they were married in around the 1st of August, 1972. Incidentally, Jean's father, Willard King, at that time was working part-time for Wilcox Outdoor Advertising and is doing various mechanic-type jobs and other related. He would later on become a full-time employee of the company, but at the time he was working part-time. So in August 1972, Keller Wilcox was a newlywed, and things were apparently going fine until one day.
You want to talk about the Neil Johannesson and the marital, the switch up that happened in the marital life of these two couples?
Well, I can. That happens later on, sort of happens a bit later on in the story. He and Jean were a member of a social group, and there was another fellow named Neil Johannesson, who, by all reports, was very handsome police. Johannesson was a very handsome police officer. He was married, as was Keller, and they ran in a social group together. A few years later, it turned out that both Jean, Keller's wife, and Neil Johannesson's wife filed for divorce within a few days of one another, and the divorces were granted within a few days of one another, a few weeks later. Later on, Jean married Neil Johannesson, and Keller was single. As things would go on, a few years later, Neil Johannesson died under what I would say are suspicious circumstances and was said to have died from autoerotic self-asphyxiation. At least that was the consensus of the coroner and others who examined the situation at the time. Keller later went on to marry another lady and named Sonia, and he got married around the 1st of November, 1980. So it had been, his marriage to Jean was fairly short-lived. And by 1980, which is a critical year in the story, he had remarried for a second time. He'd married for a second time.
Let's go back. And so let's go back to Lamar Advertising. And we talked about the situation where things were changing with the Beautification Act, but also that Lamar Advertising was offering accounting services to small companies like Wilcox Advertising. So on August 29th, tell us about this plan and the plan for the company to meet in Atlanta with Foxy and Keller.
It's kind of hard to imagine today, but back in the dark ages, before computers, I guess we've all lived through those, books were being kept by hand. But the 1980s and the years that followed were certainly a transition when everyone moved from handwritten bookkeeping to a computerized bookkeeping. Wilcox Advertising recognized that it needed to move up in the world. So they had an affiliation agreement with Lamar Outdoor Advertising, which is still a well-known company in that field. On, I believe it was August 29th, 1972, Keller and his father went to Atlanta, and you have to understand that's to the northern part of the state of Georgia. They drove to Atlanta and met with others, including the executives of the Lamar Advertising Company. They stayed there for a couple of days and returned back to Valdosta on the 31st of August, arriving sometime that afternoon. And that the time of their arrival became a critical figure later.
Now, this is according to Foxy and Keller about their time arriving back from this trip back to the office. What do they observe? What do they report? How does the police find out about what happens? Tell us what happens as soon as they get back to this office, according to them.
Well, according to them, they got back to the office in the time actually varies. There were several times that they said they got back to the office. But when they got there, it was apparently around 4:30 between 4 and 4:30 by the initial report. I want to make that clear. They came up and Helen Hanks, the secretary, her car was in the parking lot. The keys were in the ignition. They opened the office door, which was unlocked. The radio was playing. The lights were on. And they called for their secretary. Helen. She was not there. They said, oh, she must be in the restroom. They waited a few minutes and knocked on the door, and she wasn't there. They searched the place according to the history that was given, and lo and behold, she was gone. There was no indications to where she went and what happened. So they called the police. The police arrived perhaps around 5:30 or thereabouts. Again, there's some slight controversy. They made a fairly perfunctory investigation of the scene, and they left thereafter. The time that they left was an issue of controversy. The police said about 6:30. Others said perhaps as late as 8 o'clock. That those numbers become important later in the story. As I noted, Keller had been married to Jean King for only about 3 weeks. And that night, there was a party being given to the newlyweds at an elegant little country resort named Ocean Pond.
Right.
And they were due there at 7 o'clock. Well, for whatever reason, they did not arrive at that time. They called and said they'd be late and didn't arrive until 9 o'clock. They were apparently checking on the missing secretary.
Now, you talk about calling his wife, mm-hmm. calling his wife, Jean, and telling her that he got in at a certain time, but that was around 5 o'clock. What did he say? And this is important at later. What time did he say that he came in? And what did he tell her at 5 o'clock regarding this Ocean Pond thing that he was supposed to attend on their behalf?
Well, he told his wife initially that he got in at 3:15 or 3:30 in the afternoon. And later, as things would sort out, there was authorities could establish a fairly good timeline as to when they left Atlanta and so forth and so on. So that seems like it would have been correct. Later, when there were conversations with authorities, that time became later, perhaps 4:30. There's a difference of an hour, hour and a half there as to when they actually arrived. Apparently, they were in one car. They went to, I believe, the elder Wilcox's house, Fox's house, dropped him off, went back to the office, and then supposedly the elder Wilcox, Foxy, came down to check on the situation. The party, which they newlyweds were due to attend, they should have, of course, gone together. This was a big deal. And as I said, these were prominent members of the community, and the party was sponsored by some other prominent members of the community. It was a social event and one that you would not dare be late to. And yet,
that's right.
Neither Foxy nor his father were there on time. They both showed up together about 9 o'clock in the evening. He told his wife that she should go ahead because he would be late. He had to work had to see what was going on with the missing secretary.
Now, we didn't talk about that Keller calls Helen Hanks her husband.
Right.
And then he comes to the office. What does he observe? What does he say he saw?
Well, he was, as noted, a prison guard,
right.
And he had gotten off work, as I recall, around 4:30, and by the time he got home, it was around 5, and it's about that time or a little after when Keller called him and said, Helen is missing. We don't know where she is. He lived in a city of Morven, which would have taken him perhaps 20, 25 minutes to get to her place of employment. And when he arrived, Keller was there, and three policemen eventually were there. He searched about, didn't find his wife. The interesting thing is that when he walked into the door, he observed Keller going through Helen's pocketbook looking for some keys. Now, you have to understand that she was the secretary, or this, I guess the word today would be the executive assistant, and
right.
She held the keys to such things as the gas tank when they used to gas up the trucks. And he handed the pocketbook to Helen's husband, James Hanks, and he fished around and found a set of keys and handed them back to Keller. These were apparently the keys to the lock on the gas pump.
Right.
And Keller made the unusual statement, which Hanks remembers, in that Keller said, quote, she won't be needing these anymore, end quote. At least that's what James Hanks, her husband, said his words were.
Wow. Now, there is a Assistant Police Chief Lois Arnold, and he also serves as the department's investigative officer. He went to the Wilcox advertising office a little bit later. Tell us what he observes and some of the things that right away are said to the media by police.
Well, he went and looked around the office and did some, I can use the word light interviewing, in my opinion, didn't seem to take the case that seriously, and
right.
Remarked fairly privately that she had probably run off with another man or something like this, which if you, once you got to know the lady, it would have been totally foreign.
Right.
And so the case was pretty, he pretty much dismissed the case and the importance of the case. Oh, she's just gone. She'll come back. She got tired of living with her husband and ran off with someone else. And there's no evidence whatsoever for that.
There were a couple Wilcox employees interviewed, though, and one was Jerry Davis and another one was John Goodman. Jerry Davis being one of the last people supposedly to have seen Helen Hanks. So what does he have to say in terms of what he saw?
Well, he said that there had been interaction between Keller and Helen, and that is Keller had grabbed Helen by her rear end and she'd turned around and slapped him or tried to slap him. Mm-hmm. And apparently he had been sexually harassing her. It was also said that Keller had referred to her using foul words and spoken badly about her, and something Keller later denied. But these were sort of unbiased reports that came along early in the case before anybody knew what the fate of Helen Hanks would eventually be. And so there was no doubt that there was evidence of sexual harassment there with Keller approaching Helen, despite the fact he'd only been married 3 weeks.
That you say that was confirmed by a second employee, John Goodman, but also that there was confirmation of something else in terms of her dissatisfaction. What else was found?
Yes, there was. There were other, it would come out later that she had spoken to at least two other females saying that she was being sexually harassed. Number one. Number two, in her pocketbook, which was still there and abandoned, there were applications for employment saying that she would be available to go to work on October 1st, which basically was 1 month after her disappearance. She intended to quit her job. She had expressed concern about several things, and this seemed to be quite well documented. At least it came up later in the investigation. But there was no doubt that something had been going on there that had driven this woman to quit a job that she'd only had about 8 or 9 months and seek other employment.
Now, there was a person named Willard King, and this is Keller's new father-in-law of just a few weeks. And he's a full-time employee of Pepsi-Cola Bottling Company in Cordell. And hadn't mentioned, but part of that trip that they had gone on, there was a stop in Cordell. Tell us about Willard King and the discovery he makes.
I will. And, you know, down here at the South, we pronounce things differently. It's actually Cordell.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
But he was working in Cordell, and on their way back from Atlanta, they stopped and met him. And he gave a timeline, his approximate time, as to when they left that city and headed to south to Valdosta. It's I-75, his expressway. And that became critical later on in establishing the timeline as to when they actually got there. It's a pretty much straight road without any deviations. And so you could accurately calculate the rate of speed, which in those days was pretty fast. And that was important. The other thing was that he would come in on the weekends working part-time at Wilcox Advertising and do various repair work. And when he came in a few days after Helen's disappearance, he noticed that one of the boxes that he normally set his tool chest was missing. When I say boxes, this advertising company had large boxes that measured perhaps 4 feet long, 2 feet wide, 2 feet high, that were covered with galvanized metal that were designed to withstand heavy use. And those were where the folded pieces of paper that would eventually put up on billboards were stored and carried. He noticed that a box was missing. In fact, he duly reported this to Keller. And Keller, who was sort of in charge of things at this point, sort of went back and forth. And he said, well, I guess we should report that to the police. So he called up the police investigator that we discussed a moment ago.
Yeah.
The investigator came around, looked at it, said, yeah, well, whatever, and didn't even make a note of it. This would turn out to be an important clue much later.
Now, he basically, as you're right, he kind of dismisses this box and its importance. But someone else within days, Governor Carter, there's a perceived crime wave, as you write. So they send Ronald Angel, the state's top criminal investigator and agent in charge of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, to come into this investigation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it should be appreciated. This was one case, and the disappearance of Helen Hikes was one case among several. There had been some violent crimes. There had been some rapes. There had been murders. And the perception was that crime was getting out of hand. And so the GBI, under the urging of the state's governor, came in and did investigate it. And one of the prominent things they investigated was the disappearance of Helen Hikes. Keller was interviewed at that time and really did not give a particularly different story from what he'd said earlier. He denied any. He and his father went to Atlanta. He had an excuse as to when he arrived and so forth and so on. And really, it didn't change anything, although I will give the GBI credit for asking. They were not there at the outset, so they sort of came in after the fact and reviewed what had been done and said, well, gee, we don't know what else to do. It's a cold case.
Yeah, you say so. There was some investigation for 3 or 4 weeks, but basically no clear leads had been established and the trail went cold.
That's correct.
Trail went cold. You write very interestingly and poignantly that James Hanks says, listen, she might have wanted to leave me, but there's no way she would have left these children.
That's exactly right. And very, very almost pitiful situation of the father having to explain to his three children that their mother's not coming back. Apparently they had a happy relationship, and apparently it was difficult, perhaps financially, but they were a hardworking family, and the loss of his wife and his helpmate was a devastating one, not only to him, but also to his family.
Yeah, you're right. That gets worse for the family while things get real rosy for the Wilcox Advertising Company and Keller and Foxy and company. But for the family, taunts at school for the children. And then one day, to their horror, there's another woman in the home and things are different completely, aren't they?
They are. At some point later, James brought home another woman. His wife was gone. No one knew where she was. No one had said that she was dead. And he started seeing another woman. And one day brought her home. And that, of course, made matters worse. The older daughter, Lucy, there were three children. The older daughter moved out at that point, horrified by this. And the younger two children didn't have much choice. David and Penny stayed there and finished their, both of them did quite well in life. Actually, all the children did well in life, but they stayed there and they didn't have another choice. And so it broke the family up, obviously, and in a way that was even equally tragic, not only with their mother having abandoned, their father bringing in a new woman, which I thought was something that was horrific to the children's psychological well-being.
You write that the Keller joins the Chamber of Commerce and various other groups and is active in the community. And we had talked about the marriage switch. So let's do that again, because that's important to what happens soon after.
What was that again?
We'll talk about the marriage happening. The one marriage dissolved, the other one, and the switch of partners and Neil Johansson.
Well, in October, I think of the same year that Johansson died, Keller married another lady, Sonia Laster, I believe her last name was. And that was in October. And actually, it was several years later. I have my dates wrong. It was in October of 1980 that they married. And that date was significant because something happened later in the month of October of 1980. If you'd like to talk about that or if you want to review some other stuff before the findings of October 1980, November 1980, forgive me.
Well, let's talk about what happens in that interim before the discovery by the Blanton brothers in 1980. But you say 3,007 days missing. What happens in that interim period of time in terms of the investigation, if anything?
Nothing. Basically, it was a cold case. There were reports, quote unquote, of sightings of Helen Hikes. There's one particular episode I talk about in the book from Penny, the daughter, who saw a woman who looked like she thought this was her missing mother, and she followed her up and turned around, and when she saw, she realized it was not her mother. The children certainly held out hope if the husband did. The Wilcoxes continued to do well. Keller became an active member of the community, joining the Rotary Club and so forth, became an active in the state organization of outdoor advertising and so forth and so on. And when he remarried, it looked like things were going very well. And the The Hill and Hanks family had sort of declined and fallen apart, but the Wilcoxes were doing fine until the Blantons came along.
Yes, and he was a volunteer auxiliary policeman as well from the mid-70s.
Yeah. He was, and I should address that too. One thing about this was you always wonder why someone would volunteer to be a volunteer auxiliary policeman because, well, what happens when you're a member of the police auxiliary? You get to wear some sort of a uniform and kind of hang out with the police, and also you know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything had any news had broken on the missing persons case of Helen Hanks, he would have been the first to know about it. And there were several episodes during that period of time when supposedly the missing Helen Hanks had called or sent word that she was alive and well and not to worry about me, as if she'd run off. And retrospectively, there was always question as to who was behind those strange messages that were received. As it turned out, that they were obviously not the case. No one ever knew.
Let's talk about the discovery on November 24th, 1980.
November 24th, 1980. Two farmers were clearing what is known in the rural South as new ground. The Blanton brothers had purchased several hundred acre tract of land, which formerly had been in timber. They were in the timber business, but they decided that this property would be more valuable if it were cleared and used for agriculture. So they cut the timber, and in order to prepare the land for agriculture, you've got to remove the stumps and the roots in the ground so that it can be plowed, and the land has to be shaped. They were doing this and using what's called as a chisel plow, or more colloquially called a root rake, which is a type of plow that you pull behind a tractor that has big tines that dig into the soil, perhaps 8 or 10 or 12 inches deep, depending on what kind of plow you're using. These grab the roots under the ground and actually pull them out of the ground, almost rake them out of the ground. So you've cleared the stumps, you're going through and getting up the small little roots so you can plant it. And lo and behold, they're driving along one afternoon and the plow hangs up on something under the ground. And one of the brothers was driving the tractor and stopped and looked back there. And he called his other brother who came over and looked in the ground. And it looked like they'd hit an underground box of some sort. You know, like, what is this doing here, you know, in the middle of nowhere? I should comment that this was south of Valdosta, perhaps a 10, a 15-minute drive from
right.
Wilcox Outdoor Advertising. Not that far, but it was in a rural area. Again, I want to stress that Valdosta is an island of urbanity and a sea of rurality.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to go very far before you're in the country.
Right.
And this was on a dirt road not that far away. And so he looked down there and said, well, let's just see if we can't jerk it out of the ground with the root rake by catching one of the tines on the box and just pulling it up. And when he did, he noticed there were bones in the box, and it's like, oh, like this is a problem. And so the police were called. They came to the site immediately. There was an investigation and site crime scene people were called as well. And Keller being notified, and a member of the police auxiliary was also there to see the box being dug up. And it was he who identified this as being similar to the missing box that had been noted by his father-in-law right after Helen Hanks went missing. So that was the first sort of serious clue that something was going on. The box was, there was obviously an investigation. It didn't take very long to develop, to discover that there was a skeleton inside this box, along with a number of other findings, which I'll get to in a moment. The skull was taken to a dentist who rapidly identified this as being the remains of Helen Hanks based on some dental work that he had done earlier.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now, you talked about the discovery of this box. But other than Helen Hayes' soon-to-be-identified skeleton in this box, there are some contentious things in regards to rigor mortis and dismemberment. As we mentioned in the opening, we talked about dismemberment.
Right. What the situation is there were some other very important things discovered under the box, and that's a key, that was apparently thrown into the grave before the box, or the ersatz grave before the box was, were a dress and underclothing, bra, panties, girdle, that kind of thing, and a set of, at least one set of keys there. Those were important. They were under the box. And so those are important things. And the dismemberment was not initially known or noted despite the small size of the box. You have to understand that the box was kind of torn up a bit as they tried to get it out of the ground. And it's hard to realize how a person who measures 5 feet, 9 inches in height could be in that box. But apparently she was. And later on, when we get to that part, someone noted that she had been dismembered. And later they reexamined the bones and saw signs of that.
Now, how do police proceed with this very new development? These same people were like Lois Arnold, the assistant police chief that was dismissing this case. How does this proceed and who comes into this case as well?
Well, you have to understand that this was a complicated and uncertain case. With the discovery of the body, everyone said, oh, gosh. And the police started investigating. Well, it didn't take them very long to realize that here is a woman who was at her place of employment, who goes missing, and her remains are found inside of a box that came from her place of employment. So obviously the prime suspects were people who worked there. So there was Keller and his father, and the remainder of the employees were a number of African American males who did the sign work. They were brought in and interviewed in some detail, and one of them remarked that her legs appeared to have been severed. And the police said, oh, gosh, we didn't see that at the examination initially. So they would, in the months that followed, re-exhume her remains were buried, but re-exhume her body, have been examined, and there were certain cut marks on the bones that appeared strongly to suggest that the legs had in fact been severed from the body in order to put her body inside this box. The investigation dragged on. By April 1981, the prime suspects appeared to be Keller, the son, and Foxy, the father, plus two African-American males, one of whom was quite elderly and was beginning to sound a little bit as if he were having memory problems. Once the police thought they had a good case in early July 1981, which was approximately 7 months, a little bit more than 7 months after the discovery of the body,
right,
they arrested Keller on a charge of murder and arrested at the same time his father and two black males as aiding, concealing a death.
Right. And that's Ed Rentz. He was a 77-year-old man, you say, and Lorenzo Marshall, 69. So they're both longtime employees.
That's correct.
And also the right away, Keller calls Wilby Coleman, local attorney, who he was related to by marriage.
Yes. Once the police showed up at Keller's house in the middle of the night, he came to the door and, according to his account, was surprised that they showed up. But they told him that he needed to come downtown so we can talk about things. And he kept saying, why? And the police asked politely, do you want to get a lawyer? And he said, why should I need a lawyer? And they told, and his wife at that point asked, why does he need one? And they said, we're arresting him for murder. At which point he asked for a lawyer and called his Wilby Coleman. Coleman was a very good lawyer and was one of the integral members of Keller's defense team thereafter. He was taken to jail. And in the meantime, his father and Ed Rentz and Lorenzo Marshall, the two other black males, were arrested and all taken to jail. The next day they were bonded out and everybody went home. But that started, again, a long legal saga.
You talk about what was brought in was famed attorney Bobby Lee Cook, a highly respected, high-profile cases, and Lamar Cole was chosen as the district attorney. And then they had to have a committal hearing to make sure there was enough evidence to take before the grand jury. What did the state reveal at that time?
Well, the state basically reviewed the testimony of the black employees that they had, in fact, been contacted on that night of August 31st, 1972, by their employer, who, again, the testimony was a little inconsistent from one to the other, but
right.
Basically they were picked up. They were told to load a box in the back of a pickup truck. They were told to drive. They rode in the pickup truck with Keller and his father to a place away from town, which is where the box was found, and they were told to dig a hole. Keller and his father watched while they dug a hole about waist deep, at which time the rain started, so they had to quit and go back. As a separate bit of testimony, they were asked what was in the box. One of the two, Ed Rentz, said that it was the body of Ms. Hanks, who at the time was nude, whose legs had been cut off and were put in a separate package inside that box. And the order of the bones had been jumbled up when it was being excavated. It was not anything that my perception was that it wasn't anything that police did in error, but that trying to jerk it out of the ground with a plow sort of jumbled things up inside the box.
Mm-hmm.
That was testimony that came in. So they felt like they had sufficient evidence to hold Keller and his father and bind them over. At that time, I should say that concealing a death was a misdemeanor in Georgia and is now a felony. So
yeah.
Keller was charged, obviously, with felony homicide. The others were charged with misdemeanor.
Needless to say, by September 4th, there's a grand jury indictment. And so how does it go from there? How's the proceedings?
Well, first of all, they had hired Bobby Lee Cook. And of course, I'm sure many of you listeners are familiar with Bobby Lee Cook, who passed away, I believe, last year. One of America's premier criminal defense attorneys. Bobby Lee had participated in the Wayne Williams murder trial.
Right.
Also in the Midnight, the Garden of Good and Evil,
mm-hmm.
did one of the trials there. He was said to be the role model for Matlock, something that he was kind of halfway to, but he was extremely well known. I live in this part of the world down here, and I never will forget going out of the courthouse square one day and seeing this fancy Rolls Royce parked there. And I said, who is that? And I said, oh, that's Bobby Lee Cook. He always comes in a chauffeured Rolls Royce. And so he had a certain style about him. And he was known to be a wizard in the courtroom, but at least he had a reputation that he carefully burnished to make sure that everyone knew he was a wizard in the courtroom. So he was also very, very expensive, according to everything I could find out.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wilcoxes could afford him, so they hired him. You ask what happened between the time of the indictment and the time of the eventual trial, which was scheduled for early 1982. There was a series of preliminary hearings, motions, and so forth that precede most trials. Nothing dramatic happened in that time period.
What I thought was interesting, I don't know how typical it is from state to state, but the Hanks family hired a special prosecutor to assist Lamar Cole in the prosecution.
That is correct. And that's no longer the practice in this state, but it has been traditionally a long practice in Georgia that the family can hire their own special prosecutor to assist. There are obviously changes in the 40 odd years since the trial. And that was one. Also, there are other such things as the number of strikes when interviewing a potential jurors. It used to be that one side got twice as many, the defense got twice as many strikes as the prosecution and so forth. Those have all changed now.
Interesting. Interesting. Let's talk about this trial and the fundamentals, the prosecution's fundamentals, what they are trying to focus on and emphasize before we talk about Bobby Lee Cook and Wilby Coleman and their approach.
The prosecution's case was made difficult by the fact that it was a case of circumstantial evidence. And you say, oh, gee, well, you have to think about it. Many, if not most, violent crimes are frequently not witnessed by anyone except the victim and the perpetrator.
Right.
Rape and murder and things like that. So these cases are often circumstantial cases. The motivation here was felt to be a sexual one. Keller had been known to be harassing his secretary, and that seemed to be well documented. He denied it, but there were others who seemed to give good testimony. The other thing was the discrepancy in the timelines that were given by the indicted, that is, the Wilcoxes, versus what the investigators could come up with. It appears, based on the investigators' evidence, that the Wilcoxes could have arrived home as early as perhaps 3:15 or 3:30, and that the police left and they didn't show up at the party until 9 o'clock. So it looks like there's a period minimum of 3 hours, an hour and a half in the afternoon and an hour and a half in the evening after the police leave the Wilcox advertising, that are unaccounted for. And it was the prosecution's contention that this period of time was when the body was hidden initially, and later they made an attempt to bury it. In testimony from Rentz and Lorenzo Marshall, the two employees, it was said that they were unable to complete the burial that night, so came back at a later time. It may have been later that evening, or it may have been another day. You have to understand that were eight years. By that time, it had been actually about 10 years since the event, and their memory seemed to have faded. But it was clear that they didn't bury the body initially, but came back either later that night or within a day or two and buried the body. That was the main things. And there were other things too, some other hard evidence, which I'll discuss if you'd like.
Sure. But let's talk about the Bobby Lee Cook and what how he approaches the cross-examination and where he focuses in terms of testimony he believes that police have been misconduct in their behavior.
It's interesting to read transcripts. Transcripts are like the script for a play, and you almost have to read them out loud to really understand them, and it's fascinating. Cook was, if nothing else, a real showman in the courtroom, and there's reference made to him raising his voice and whispering at times and just being very dramatic in the way he spoke. He was given very much to hyperbole, saying, "This is the worst case of anything that I've ever seen in my 3 or 4 decades of practicing law," and so forth, something to that effect. And he basically sought to focus on the fact that there was, well, I say Cook and Coleman as well, there was no hard evidence to tie Keller Wilcox to the case. And I want to make it clear, in case it's not, at this point, we're only talking about the trial of Keller Wilcox because he was the only one who came to trial. And I want to make that clear.
Right.
Okay. There was no hard evidence to tie Keller to the murder. No, this was in the days, of course, before DNA, but there was nothing else that specifically tied him to the murder. The fact that the witnesses, all of whom were African-American, were interrogated harshly, to say the least, was not anything that police should be proud of, and was contended to be something that was may have cast some doubt as to the veracity of their testimony. And basically, they just attacked the case left and right. Any bit of evidence or any conclusion that the prosecution drew, the defense would say, "Oh, that's just crazy."
Let's talk about the crucial evidence that was possibly inadvertently thrown into that grave and provided evidence at this trial. Talk about those keys.
There was several things. One, I have to give Lamar Cole credit. One was this was said to be a sex crime. And one of the things they noted was that the deceased, Helen Hanks, apparently had been strangled with a rope. There was evidence presented by experts that this rope probably was looped around her neck. There was evidence that her clothing, that is her dress, she had on a blue dress, a bra, underclothes, had been cut off her body and presumably were when she was tied up and everything. And these were all ancillary things. The main thing that seemed to be important was the keys. If you recall earlier, I said that when James Hanks came up there, came to the place, to the office there, he saw Keller Wilcox digging through Helen's pocketbook, and the comment was made about she won't be needing these anymore. Well, two things. When they got back to the office later, it was quote unquote discovered that the key and the lock to the gas pump was missing.
Okay.
Helen Hines would have been in charge of that. Those keys were apparently in her pocketbook and were apparently given to Keller. Whether or not they got accidentally caught up in the stuff that was thrown into the grave, that was a major consideration. So it may have been that this was accidentally leaving evidence. The second thing was that Keller, there was a pickup truck. It was Barris described as tan or something like that, that Keller drove. There were only two keys to that pickup truck. They obviously drove it there, then obviously drove it back. It was Keller's truck, so he had to have one key to crank it up with. And the other key to that truck was found in the bottom of the grave. So that was considered very strong evidence in terms and physical evidence that supported the prosecution's contention that Keller was, in fact, the murderer.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, despite Bobby Lee Cook and Wilbie Coleman and their best efforts to cast doubt, Keller, when he testifies at that trial, you say doesn't do himself any good, not what he had wanted. He has to stick to his father's timeline and basic story. What is the verdict? The jury deliberates for a short period of time. Tell us about that.
Verdict was that Keller was found guilty of murder and was sentenced to life in prison for the murder and an additional 12 years for concealing a death, which was the misdemeanor that he was also convicted of. The jury was polled later, and there was a long period of several appeals over the years. And they were initially reluctant to speak. One of them said that he was a little uncertain until Foxy Wilcox, the father, took the stand and testified definitively about the timeline. And then Keller had to back him up. And he said he realized that the Wilcoxes were simply lying. And he said everything else fell into place at that point. Keller ended up going to prison initially for a while.
Yes. You talk about it. He goes to prison, and obviously Wilbie Coleman, as you say, he's outraged at this verdict and continues to want to appeal this sentence and conviction. So there are numerous appeals, and there are state appeals. And when those are exhausted, it goes to federal appeals. Tell us what happens in the case of a Judge Owens.
Judge Wilbur Owen he's recently been deceased within the last few years, was a federal judge from Macon, Georgia, which is what was the area of federal court. He was prevailed upon by the defense to look at this case. He saw that he was involved fairly early, but said that he could not get involved as a judge until they had run the state appeals. The appeals, basically for a new trial or an overturned verdict, ran the entire gamut of the state judicial system to the Georgia Supreme Court, in which case it went to the federal system. Wilbur Owen was outraged, he stated, because of the way the African-American witnesses were interviewed, and stated that he believed that the evidence when their testimony was excluded, that the evidence was insufficient to convict Keller. And so basically in early 1985, late 1985, he let him out of jail. He freed him from the state prison system and said that unless new evidence was found, that Keller was completely off the hook. He could not be retried because the double jeopardy clause that does not allow repeat charges for the same offense. And it looked like Keller was going to rejoin his second wife and get on with his life. But the state chose to appeal this system to the in the federal court system, and Owens' ruling was overturned, and Keller was sent back to jail after a brief period of, I recall, about 4.5 months of freedom there for a while. The case eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court did not think that it needed to be reviewed, and they confirmed the opinion of the 11th Circuit Court, which is the federal district that we're in.
It's interesting. They affirmed Judge Owens' decision.
Right, right. I'm sorry if I didn't say that correctly. They did overturn Judge Owens' decision. Forgive me. And it was the federal system that sent Wilcox back to prison.
Right. And then that overturning was affirmed then,
right,
regardless of the language. But you said what's very interesting was the amount of reversals when you looked and when they looked or when authorities looked, that Owen had the most reversals of any federal judge.
Well, you know, this is, if I can inject a little personal note in here, when I write something like this, I don't think that I should be editorializing. I don't think I should be, you know, giving my opinion as an author. I want to do Joe Friday just the facts, ma'am. I want to present the story as it happened and let the reader make his or her own decision. But in this case, it was a controversial decision, to say the very least, to overturn this conviction. Owen's decision was very controversial to free Keller. And at that time, I just happened to notice in the American Bar Journal, ABA Journal, American Bar Association Journal, that someone had looked at the rate at which federal judges had their rulings overturned. And Wilbur Owens at the time was the winner. He'd had more rulings overturned than any other judge. He got very enraged at this. But that was the case. And this was simply another ruling in which he was overturned. It wasn't my research. It was quoted in an article from the American ABA Journal.
Right. You talk about Keller trying for parole and being denied. Of course, the Hanks family is obviously in opposition. And he states that he claims his innocence throughout this parole process. How does that change? When does that change? Tell us about him finally getting parole.
He changed lawyers after he'd been in prison for a while. And after he'd served nearly 25 years, he hired a different law firm to represent him. The law firm, one of the attorneys in that law firm was actually the former attorney general who had put him back in jail, put him back in prison by appealing his ruling to the 11th Circuit.
Now,
the same individual is now in private practice, so he agrees to take up his Keller's case and get him out of prison.
Yeah,
they tried to get him released on the merits. That is to say, that the same arguments that had been rejected by multiple courts. And when that didn't work, they tried simply to say, "Well, he's just served too long in prison. It was 25 years," and so eventually that worked. And he was freed in 2008, I believe, has been free since then.
What I found was very, very interesting, and as you write as well, is that he denied that he had committed the crime for so long. Then he brings in a law firm to help him. And basically, one of the criteria for parole always is that this recognition that you committed responsibility for the crime itself and some kind of genuine or a show of remorse.
Well, that's true. And I should address that. He was represented by Mike Bowers and Tom Morgan, who were the attorneys for his appeal. And he had sometime during this time frame written a letter to the parole board where he, quote unquote, confessed. And in this letter, it's a handwritten letter, and I have a copy of it. It's in the files. It says that he regretted, I'll quote it, "I want to acknowledge and accept responsibility for the death of Helen Hanks on August 31, 1972. Quote, we got into an argument and I lost my temper. I did not mean to hurt her, end quote. He denied sexual assault, study that he was not present when Ms. Hanks' body was buried. And the headline on the local paper when this was made public said, was, quote, Wilcox confesses question mark. This confession was one where he took responsibility and admitted his culpability and expressed his sorrow, but it didn't really match the fact. And so it was considered by many to be a somewhat cynical document to get him paroled, but he was paroled and has been out since that period of time.
Yes, very, very interesting. You talk about karma, you call it karma in your epilogue. Only 6 inches deeper, and that's importance.
Let me get personal here, and you know, people say, you know, why'd you choose to write this book, or why this and that? You know, followed this case. I'm in 1982. I was absolutely fascinated by this case, and back in the day, I used to read the newspaper in the morning when I'd come into my office and sit there, and if it was something fascinating, I'd tear it out, put it in a drawer, and about once a year, I'd look at it. And I realized at the end of the year, I had just a whole huge stack of clippings about this. This was in the day prior to computers. I had a whole stack of clippings about the Wilcox murder case. And I don't know why it fascinated me, but in writing this story, one thing that struck me is this. All of us, in some way, shape, or form, lesser or greater, have a fear of something that we have done or something we're afraid that someone might find out about. It may be something minor. Perhaps when you were 5 years old, you stole a candy bar from the local convenience store and your mother said, don't you ever, you know, do that. Or it may be that you're an adult and you cheated on your spouse but managed to get away with it, or you embezzled from your employer. But yet everybody has something somewhere that they just don't want made public. Can you imagine what it's like to be handsome, wealthy, married, have everything you want? And at night, when you turn out the lights and you're all alone by yourself in the bed, you sit there and say, there's a buried body out there. And if it ever is found, my whole life will explode and everything I have will go bad. Well, this is the situation here. Everyone's life was taking one direction, one trajectory, and good, bad, indifferent, whatever. And then when this box was dug up, everything changed. And if the box had only been buried 6 inches deeper, none of this would happen, and we would be having this conversation. That's the fascinating thing about this book. And that's why I label the last little one paragraph epilogue Karma, K-A-R-M-A.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting and similar to many stories that the victim inadvertently help solve this case very much by that dress catching up into that padlock. And yes. I'm sure that some of that evidence was inadvertently thrown into that gravesite.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much, William Rawlings, for 6 inches Deeper, The Disappearance of Helen Hanks. Do you have a website that people might want to take a look at more further information?
I do. And if you can remember my name, you can get it. It's simply www.WilliamRawlings, WILLIAMRAWLINGS, WilliamRawlings.com. And it has my speaking engagements. It has a review of my books, both fiction and nonfiction. This book, by the way, was, I think, my 10th book. My 12th book has just been released. And my 13th book is coming out next year, so I continue to write.
Thank you so much. 6 inches Deeper, The Disappearance of Helen Hanks. Thank you so much, William Rawlings. You have a great evening and good night.
Thank you.